7th, and I am at the home of David Kelly Welch in Tucson, Arizona, and this is for the Oral History Project for the Bird Polar Research Center Archival Program, funded by the National Science Foundation. Okay, Kelly, as you've asked me to call you, can you tell me what attracted you to a career in the military, specifically the Navy?
Well, I graduated from college in 1940, and as you know from my CV, it was Franklin College in Indiana, and all of us knew that there was a war coming. And having been born in 1918, I grew up with people whose parents were in World War I, and I learned an awful lot about standing in trenches with water up to your ankles and carrying packs, 70-pound packs, for 30 miles and stuff like that. And that wasn't for me. And knowing that the war was coming, I decided on the Navy. And so in 1940, I got into something called the V-7 program, which was taking college graduates and sending off for 3 months to some preparatory school and turning them into an officer and a gentleman.
Okay.
And I went to the Naval Academy, where first I went on a cruise on a battleship, the USS Arkansas, and we cruised to Panama and back to New York. And then I went to the Naval Academy for 3 months, and lo and behold, that strange place turned out being to an officer and a gentleman. And hence, I was in the Navy. And at the end of the war, I transferred from the reserve to the regular Navy and liked it because I liked the Navy. And so I stayed in the Navy.
Okay. How do you think your work in the Antarctic as commander of Task Force 43, Operation Deep Freeze, influenced your career in the Navy? Do you think it was a good career move? Or bad, or how can you characterize that?
Chances are it was not a good career move. No flag officer who went to the Antarctic ever made another star.
Really?
It was just a dead end because the Navy went past you the 2 years you were doing this. And you weren't in a place that was doing things for the Navy. But personally, it was a wonderful, wonderful tour. And Antarctica is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And it's huge. And there's so much to learn about it, and we're still learning.
Absolutely. What can you tell me about your relations with the National Science Foundation while you were commander of the Naval Support Force in Antarctica?
Well, the next question is, who's the director? And the guy who sort of ran the program when I was there was Dr. Tom Jones.
Okay.
Tom was a chemist, and he came from a Quaker school in Pennsylvania to the National Science Foundation and really fell in love with the Antarctic program. And I got along with Tom very well indeed.
Okay.
And I think that the Antarctic program, the Navy in Antarctica, did not get along very well with the National Science Foundation. And I think the scientists resented the fact that the Navy was responsible for the safety of everyone, and therefore, matter of fact, the director of the program, the Navy head shed, was responsible by a presidential edict for the safety of everyone in Antarctica. Hence, that person set up rules. And that scientists don't like to take orders from the military in any, whether they're naval officers or Army or Air Force or whatever.
Okay. Let's see.
But one of the things about, I heard a flag officer who was installing a new commanding officer of VXE-6, which was the Navy Aviation Squadron that flew all the aircraft when I was there, said that this was an organization that was combat ready for peace. And I thought that was really quite unusual, and it is so. And so all of us who were down there weren't down there to make war or to increase our war-making skills, but were there to support science in the best way we could. And the Antarctic Treaty prohibits military operations.
Yes.
And hence, that's what we did. And we furnished logistic support to the science program and did it the best we knew how.
Okay, so your role as naval personnel and all other naval personnel was really to support the scientists.
Yes.
Very good. And that kind of leads, that's kind of question four too. Did you accompany any scientists into the field?
No. My job, strangely enough, this is kind of facetious, but my job was to escort VIPs on through the ice.
Okay.
And they were United States citizens. They were, one time I took the senior diplomatic representative for all the Antarctic Treaty nations to the South Pole. And I took our ambassador from Australia to the South Pole and escorted them around and explained things, introduced them to the scientists that I knew, and so forth.
So there were a lot of visits from VIPs to the Antarctic.
Yeah, I spent, I guess, 3 weeks out of four on the ice.
Okay.
And the other week in New Zealand, doing the planning and getting ready for the next group of VIPs. And had to outfit them, brief them, see that they knew the rules of not walking off by themselves. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the rules we had even for scientists. Don't go out walking by yourselves, because storms can come up, blizzards, in just a few minutes. And we didn't have very many, as they do now, didn't have very many weather stations. There were maybe six on the whole of Antarctica.
Okay, so to predict?
Yeah, to say what was going on over there that
right.
was coming your way.
Coming our way, okay.
Now they have stations automatic that they drop various places.
Okay, so there are only about six stations then. Okay. We discussed, or briefly on email, we had a little conversation about David Elliott's work in Antarctica. Could you just go ahead and say for the tape basically what you told me in the email, and that is, what can you tell me about David Elliott's work in Antarctica?
Well, David Elliott ran a group that when I was there. He ran a group of mostly geologists and paleontologists, vertebrate paleontologists. And you asked, the question here is asked, was I there when David discovered the first dinosaur? And David didn't. He himself did not discover the first dinosaur. The first ancient bone was discovered by a New Zealander named Dr. Peter Barrett. And he still acted in Antarctica, as a matter of fact. And this was, what, 1967, 1968. And Peter told me that they had this place marked off with strings and 1 meter squares. And he knew just where he was, and he found this bone and recognized what it was, and he immediately forgot what square he was in, where he was. He was so excited. And I think it was a labyrinthodont bone, which means the teeth were a labyrinth, probably all wrinkled up and so forth, and I didn't see this piece of jawbone. But while I was there, under David Elliott, at his place of research, which was a place called Coal Sack Bluff, because there was coal there. Coal Sack Bluff, there was a Dr. Ned Colbert. And Ned Colbert is from northern Arizona, and he's still living there. He is a world-class vertebrate paleontologist. I found two of his books in the public library in Kenya, for example, in Nairobi.
Okay.
While I was visiting over there one time. Anyhow, he was there and he discovered a Lystrosaurus. Lystrosaurus had already been discovered in India and in South Africa.
Okay.
And the following year was a researcher named Dr. Jim Kitchen from Witwatersrand University in South Africa, and he too discovered different things. I don't have pictures of Dr. Colbert, but I do have pictures of Jim Kitchen and something that he discovered down there. I have no idea what it is. But he was walking along and there was a rock and he saw something sticking out of the rock. And when he hit it with his geology hammer, it split open and there was a skeleton, a small thing. So,
very interesting.
But later on, maybe 10 years ago, David Elliott did discover a dinosaur down there. And it was a huge dinosaur, not like a Lystrosaurus. And it is called a Cryolophosaurus Eliotti is its name now. And the cryo for cold, lofo, it's crested, and saurus, because it's a lizard, and Eliotti for David Elliott. And he didn't excavate this thing, somebody else did, and his name escapes me. But that will be, I dare say, brought back to Ohio State or someplace when it gets all discovered and put together.
Right.
He did a fantastic job. You asked me later on if I took any David Gould or Larry Gould out there.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry Gould and whoever was the president of Texas Tech at the time, they were both on the Antarctic Committee for the National Science Foundation. And they were both down there at the time, and I saw that they both got out to that place. And I did send messages to the Science Foundation, said they ought to get a PR guy down to look at some of these things, because it was really pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did for Dr. Gould, I asked David Elliott, and he put on a sheet of yellow paper that scientists transcribe things on, a map of Cold Sack Bluff and where they were digging and where this Lystrosaurus was found. And he signed it. And I gave that to Dr. Gould. So somewhere in Dr. Gould's possessions, here's this 8 by 8.5 by 11 framed map drawn by Dr. Gould of where this was.
Okay.
Dr. Gould lived here. There's now a building at the university named for him. And it was named while he was still alive.
Oh, that's kind of unusual,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, he was a fantastic man. He has something like 24 honorary doctorates.
Wow.
He was Bird's number 2 in 1929. And he took, I have a copy in down there of a video that was taken of him at that time on a dog sled trip that he laid caches, because Bird flew to the South Pole, and if they had to land or they crashed, they would know where these things were.
Right. And you have a video of that?
Yes.
So I assume that was a video made from some original film at some point.
Yeah, from movies made at the time.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting to note. Because you know we have the Bird papers and all that, so that's stuff kind of linked. It's nice to know.
You must have a copy of that video. Sometimes.
We probably do. We have a lot of film.
Yeah.
We have a lot of film in the collection, and a lot of it's been transferred to video and cleaned. And
yeah, this was given me by Yar Petrosian, I think his name is, who is an anthropologist at the U of A, who was down on the ice just a year or so ago.
Wow, very good.
I had a dog and pony show. And I still have a slideshow using two projectors. And I gave it to the Explorers Club here, and Yar was there at this thing.
Okay, and so once you gave your slideshow, he gave you the copy of the video.
Well, he gave it to me before that, but he was at the, he's a member of the Explorers Club.
Right, okay.
Was there.
All right. Can you describe for us a typical day, a typical day for you at the station in Antarctica?
Yes, a typical day for me would be at McMurdo. I had my own Quonset hut, and I could keep guests, and two or three guests in there. And I ate there, and it had, because I was there during the boreal summer. Mm-hmm. It was light 24 hours a day, and so we had blankets over the windows so you could get some sleep at night.
Was that difficult, living in...
When you first got there, yes. Mm-hmm. But you soon, you know, it's just like on the various stations, the Pole Station and Bird Station, or anywhere on the ice, the thing that kept the schedule was meal hours. And the Navy, when I was there, the Navy were the cooks. And so the cook said, we'll have lunch at 12 o'clock, we'll have dinner at 5:30, and they had a clock, and they kept those schedules, and that was what made the day. Otherwise, it was just all the same.
Right. Right. I can't imagine that myself.
Yeah.
I think it'd be hard. But harder to be in 6 months of darkness.
We had a retired Rear Admiral who was also a chemist who went to the Science Foundation, and I took him down there at one time. Well, I'll talk about this later.
Okay. You can feel free to talk about it whenever the mood hits you. So if you want
to
talk
about
it.
Anyhow, I too had along with the Red, I had two stewards, and they cooked my food and prepared it. And also, if I had guests, they prepared the food for the guests and that were living with me. And we would walk around the station and to the Science Foundation, had a scientist place, and they had a science lab. And I would take the guests into those places and introduce them, and the guests, depending on their background, would talk to the scientists. And we'd go to Scott Base, and we'd come back in time for lunch, and we usually had a number of people at lunch in my cabin, and then we'd go off, and perhaps we'd fly to the South Pole, and we'd stay there overnight. We might go to Bird Station first, then to the South Pole, and then if we didn't stay overnight, we'd fly back, because there's not an awful lot of room at the South Pole, or at Bird Station either, for that matter. And Bird Station at that time was completely under the snow, because it was built before we knew much about building things on the ice, and we used either a Quonset hut or a James Way hut. A James Way hut looked like a Quonset hut, except the instead of metal on the outside, it was canvas.
Oh, okay.
And there was another canvas on the inside, insulation in between. And these could be transported, and they were on a frame, so it looked like a Quonset hut. And you just put the canvas over the frames, and the frames rested on the snow, and there was a wooden base, that you put a stove on so that you'd have heat. And there was a sort of a vestibule on the outside, so you could go into the vestibule and then go into the canvas hut so the wind would go screaming through the hut.
Okay.
And that whole thing was transported by C-130 aircraft that the Navy ran, and we would go and take a science party in and maybe put up, depending on how big the party was, put up one, two, three, maybe four of these James Way huts. And that's where the scientists would live, and we would have the C-130s would fly over, and we furnished radios so that we could talk to them. We flew over to find out if they were sick, if they needed anything, and we tried to do that more than once a week, going over them.
So when you say you're going over them, you're checking on them to make sure everything's going all right.
Yes,
and they don't need anything.
Yes, and if they needed things, and
you would
sometimes
arrange that.
We'd put one or maybe two helicopters with them. And the helicopters are not all that reliable. And so they might need spare parts, or they might whatever.
And helicopters not reliable because it's cold or because...
No, because
just
they're
the
helicopters.
Equipment.
They're just a different critter. Matter of fact, at one time, all the helicopters in the Navy of this particular type were grounded. Ours were fine, but we couldn't fly them. And here we were with helicopters out at remote stations, trying to fly people various places. The scientists, for example, we couldn't fly them anyplace. We couldn't even fly them back to where they could get into a C-130.
Wow. Okay. We kind of talked about this a little bit, but not very much. Did you have any problems with morale during the winter due to isolation and darkness? Or any problems with morale in general, I guess?
Morale, no. The problems that we had, I had a flight surgeon that was on my staff, and he would interview both the scientists, civilians, and the Navy people who were going to winter over.
Okay.
As I say, at the South Pole, for example, there might have been only 20 people in the winter.
Right.
And half of those would be civilians and half would be the Navy. Cooks, maintenance people, the officer in charge who was responsible for the safety of all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that you interview these people, and he was assisted by a psychiatrist, an MD, in interviewing these things, looking for strange things. Because if, for example, every time you sit down to dinner, you put a knife in one hand and a fork in the other and say, "All right, bring it on," pretty soon that gets very old. And so you interview people to see how they get along together.
Okay.
And one of the things that we had liquor at all our stations, McMurdo, Pole, and Bird Station. And one of the problems was, and you can't really find this out very easily, is a Lush. And at the Pole Station, we had a Lush, and he was a civilian, and he was a weatherman. And he belonged to the Weather Service. And one of the problems with that was that his civilian friends kept bringing him beer. I mean, the guy who was in charge of safety, the naval officer in charge, said, "No more booze for you. You get drunk and you're not reliable." And so the civilians got around that and this is what I mean by scientists not liking to get along with the military. And so he could send out messages, and he sent me messages, and I was back in Washington at the time, saying he was going to hire Louis Neisser and sue me and sue the Navy when he got back, but he never did. As soon as that airplane showed up in October, he was so glad to get out of there that he just forgot the whole thing. But that is the kind of thing that is very difficult. But in morale, the people who lived there, the Navy, we didn't have morale problems. And the civilians didn't have morale problems either. They were there because they wanted to be there.
Okay. I've heard that before about little irritating habits people
yeah.
have and how little things that normally you could ignore really grate on people after they
yeah.
had to...
And it doesn't take very long.
Right. Living so closely. Let's see. Oh, in some of your correspondence with me, you mentioned that you had some unusual events that occurred, and I was wondering if you'd like to talk about that.
Sure. There are several things that happened while I was in Antarctica. One is that I was selected by the ambassador to Australia, whom I'd taken to the ice, to come to Australia and represent the United States in the Coral Sea celebration. As you may remember, in 1943, something like that, there was the Battle of the Coral Sea, where these Japanese naval force and the American naval force had this big battle, and the ships never saw each other. It was all aircraft. First battle was ever done that way. And the Japanese were on the way to invade Australia. And if this hadn't happened, the Australians would be calling their honorable ancestors now the Japanese. And so every year, the Australian American Association sponsors somebody and represent the United States to come over. And I was the one this year. In 1971, this was.
Okay.
And no other person from Antarctica had done that, and Mary and I both went, and we had a C-130 that we took to the ice equipped with skis, and we flew that to Australia. First, we stopped in New Zealand, where I had a dog and pony show. I had a canned speech that I gave, and I did it in New Zealand. It was good practice for me, and the people in New Zealand knew me anyhow. And in one talk, I gave this talk, and the Prime Minister of New Zealand was on the floor in front of me, just kneeling with his legs crossed. And I'd never had that happen before, the head of state in front of me giving this kind of a talk. But then we went to Australia, and I made a speech in every capital in Australia. And some of them were formal, and I was in formal uniform. Mary was in long dresses, and we were taken around, and Mary was held koala bears in her arms, for example. And I was taken in various clubs and so forth, and gave out pictures and things like that. And I went to meet the Prime Minister and took him a tray of some kind, and he gave me a picture, which I have here still. And he was married at that time, and I met her too, to an American, which is kind of nice. And I've forgotten his name. It's been 30 years. But in every city, at one of them, I met the wife of a famous Antarctic explorer whose name escapes me. And she was Dutch. And that was in Brisbane, not in Brisbane, but in
Boston.
I've forgotten the town, not Melbourne. The next one south. But we flew across the country, flew across that great long railroad that runs 400 miles and never a curve in it across the desert. And in Perth, I made two speeches to the same folks, because one was in Perth and one was in the seaport, whatever the town is, there. And the Americans had been there in World War II. The submariners had been there. And many submariners married Australian girls and brought them back. There will be have some here in Tucson. Submariners have married Australians.
Very interesting.
But anyhow, in Brisbane, Mary and I were at the head of a parade in a car. My flag was flying on the fender of the car, and we had a 42-piece band in front of us as going along. And Mary had watched the Queen, and so we knew how to wave out the window, you know, that kind of stuff.
That's important.
Yeah. Well, it was
a
very interesting trip, and we met lots of people. The Australian Navy assigned me an aide, the commander that sort of ran, told me who was going to be at the next one and so forth. Lord Casey, we met him, and I had lunch with him, just the two of us, one time, and there's the Australians named a station for him, Casey Station, on the Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And he had been the Australian ambassador to the United States. Wonderful man. I think the only Australian, at that time anyhow, the only Australian lord, English lord.
Did you have any other unusual things you'd like to discuss?
Yes, that was one. Second, the State Department had a request from the King of Tonga to come to the ice. Now, Tonga is a tropical island, and the State Department was a little afraid to have the head of state come to the ice and come to the South Pole, which is 9,100 feet above sea level, and is very cold. The average temperature is something like -3 degrees, and thought he might drop dead. So they sent me and Mary and a C-130 and the crew and so forth to Tonga to talk him out of it. And so we went up there with pictures and my dog and pony show. And I took up a guy who was an expert in penguins, Rich Penny. Dr. Rich Penny was his name. And we showed him these pictures and talked to his staff, his personal staff, as to why he couldn't go, why the United States didn't want him to go. And he was a huge man. He's one of the biggest men I've ever seen. He was, I guess, 6'4", 6'5". When he shook my hands, his thumb and fingers met around my hands. And he was, his mother had been at Queen Elizabeth's inauguration.
Oh, how interesting.
Coronation.
Wow.
And she rode with Haile Selassie in an open carriage, and it was raining. And she was the size of the king. Great, huge woman. And she was Queen I guess they call her Salat, but it was Charlotte, named for, I think, Edward VII's wife or something like that. Anyhow, we did talk him out of it, and I did get to meet. Mary took, all at my expense, a great tray, silver tray that was engraved about our visit, and gave it to the king. Mary took a suitcase that came that way, full of cosmetics, to give to the queen. And the queen gave Mary a tapa cloth rug, which is too big to sit up anywhere in this house.
Wow.
And it has her name inscribed in it. And I've got to give that to a museum or something. We have it here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful tapa cloth. Well, that's the second thing. It was this trip, and I went in full uniform. I wore a sword, get off the airplane, inspected the guard, and they had a band. And when I got back to the United States, I stopped at the Navy Music School and sent the band arrangement of the Star Spangled Banner there. Okay, that's the second thing. The third thing is I was responsible and approved the first women scientist at Antarctica. And I don't know whether you've seen the traffic just recently. The head scientist was Dr. Lois Jones. Lois Jones now has that liver disease, cirrhosis of the liver, non-alcoholic, and she's dying. And Pete Anderson has been sending out things to all the folks who might have remembered that, and I wrote her a nice letter, and he's acknowledged that and she's in Westerville, Ohio, wherever that is.
That's very near where I live, actually.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, they were there, and they were in the Dry Valleys. You know about the Dry Valleys. Mm-hmm. And that one of the Dry Valleys, and Lake Vanda was there, and the Vanda River, and they are dry, and they were doing research. This is Lois Jones, and she had four helpers, scientists helpers. And I took them to the South Pole. And they were the first women in the history of the Earth to set foot at the South Pole. And so the press was over me like white on rice. Who's going to be the first woman off the airplane to be the first woman in history to be at the South Pole? So I thought that over for a while, and you may know the C-130s have a ramp that's quite wide at the rear. And so I got these gals and a newspaper lady from the Detroit Free Press, and the six of us lined up in arms, and we all stepped off together. So there were six ladies, were the first ladies at the South Pole, and Lois Jones was one. So I'm quite pleased with that.
Mm-hmm.
And now I started to tell you a story about this Navy Rear Admiral who was, after he retired, was employed by the Science Foundation, who was down on the ice, and I took him on a trip, and we went to Bird Station, and there was a lady scientist there named Dr. Mahwini, and what she was doing I don't know. But she had equipment there, and she had a lady assistant whose name escapes me. But she took this man in hand and took him around and showed him everything. And when they got all finished with what they were doing, she said, "Well, let's have a drink." And so they went into the mess hall, and she went to the refrigerator to open it up, and pretty soon she came back to him with a very sheepish expression on her face. The South Pole is on 7,000 feet of ice. And she said to him, "Would you believe it? We're out of ice."
Funny.
Okay, but those are three things that I did, I think, that nobody before me had done, and I don't think anybody since has done.
Okay, I think you recalled the wife of the person that you had met, so I'll let you talk about that.
Yes, it was Douglas Mawson's wife. As I say, she was Dutch, and Douglas Mawson was a famous Australian explorer of Antarctica and writer about Antarctica. And he wrote a wonderful book called Mawson's Will, which I have a copy of here, about his journey with two other people to find, I believe, to find the magnetic South Pole, which is now off the coast, but it wasn't then. And the other two perished, and he was the only one that came back. And when he got back to the station from which they started, the keeper of the station looked at him and said, "Which one are you?" Couldn't recognize him because he was in such terrible shape, and his clothes were just nothing.
Amazing. Okay.
Mary, this has to do with those peculiar things. I don't know, other people have flown to Antarctica in small aircraft, but one came through Christchurch on the way, and this was Max Conrad. Max Conrad was known as the Flying Grandfather, and he flew Piper aircraft from South Africa to New Jersey nonstop. And he did it all with the seat of his pants. And he didn't use fancy instruments, and he wanted to go to the South Pole. And I fought this as much as I could with the Science Foundation, and which really had very little to say about it, and the Navy, which had everything to say about it. And I finally got a message back from somebody in the Navy, in the office of the Chief of Naval Operations, a Vice Admiral, who said, "We'd like to see this grand old man go to the South Pole." So he came to Christchurch, was living in his airplane. We invited him to stay with us. And it so happened that Mary was a classmate of his niece and had met him before. So he came out and stayed with us. And eventually he flew to McMurdo, and we flew C-130s across him and gave him steers, saying, "Come left or look to or come right," and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he did the same thing on his way from McMurdo to the South Pole. And he landed at the South Pole. He got there with his aircraft. But when he took off, he crashed at the South Pole. And he was going back through the Antarctic Peninsula. How he was going to get there, I don't know, because he had instrumentation in his aircraft, but he couldn't use it. He didn't know how to use it. Mm. But he told me later that when he took off, he said everything turned black. So he did a 270 and came around and landed crossways on the runway.
Wow.
And crashed. And I don't know whether his airplane is still there or not. Probably not, but I don't know.
But he obviously survived it.
He survived that without a scratch, yeah.
Okay, wow.
And we flew him back to, and he took a commercial plane back to the States. He also told us that was the first time in X years, I don't know how many years, that he had not owned an airplane.
Or been in debt.
Okay.
He was a barnstormer in the days of barnstormers.
Why don't you tell the story, Mary?
Why did you leave that out?
He was a barnstormer, and he'd fly around and take people for rides, you know, 10-minute ride in an airplane. And there was a lady who started to walk into a propeller one time that was turning. And he jumped for her and rescued her, and the propeller hit him in the head, cut his head open. I mean, it really went through his skull. And he went to the hospital, and he came out. And when he came out, he couldn't read nor write. And he knew that he could fly, but he didn't remember ever learning to fly. And so he went to get a job someplace, and he got an interview, and the guy said, "Fine, now take this paper and fill it out, your name and address, that sort of thing." And he couldn't write. So he took it and went into the bathroom and left and had somebody else fill it out for him. He was a crazy man.
Okay. Can you think of anything else along the lines of your unusual stories that you want to share?
No, I think that's enough.
Did we cover them?
Yeah.
What brought you, well, we'll kind of switch gears here. What brought you to Tucson after you retired from the Navy?
I came to Tucson for a job. We decided to move from Washington, D.C. area. We lived just outside Washington in McLean. And so we sold our house, put our furniture in storage. And about that time, I decided that, and we were going to the Seattle area, to Anacortes, or what's the name of the island?
Whidbey Island,
yes. And, or Friday Harbor. So we had a dear friend at Friday Harbor. Just before we left, I interviewed for a job. I interviewed a man who was the president of the Association of Universities for Research in Astronomy, ORA, which was made up of a number of universities, Ohio State being one. And as a matter of fact, the current head of the astronomy department at Ohio State is a man that used to be here at Kitt Peak and is a friend. And he was in Chile for some time. In any case, we got to a dude ranch where we've been going for some years, and I got a telephone call from this man that interviewed me, and he said, he wanted to offer me a job, and it took me a long time, a couple of nanoseconds, to say okay. So I drove to Tucson with our Airedale, and Mary took an airplane from Denver to Whidbey Island to Seattle to tell those folks that we weren't coming, which we weren't. And then she came down here. So I came and I took a job, and I worked for ORA, A-U-R-A, for 5 years, and the company moved back to Washington, D.C., and I decided to retire again, so I retired again and stayed here. We like it in Tucson very much.
What do you think, you've kind of talked about this, but I guess on a more general level, what do you think have been the most important accomplishments of your career? I think you spoke a little bit about taking the women out to the ice, you felt was very important.
Important for the Antarctic program.
Right.
In my career, important accomplishment. One of the things that I'm responsible for was setting up the riverboat force in southern Vietnam, South Vietnam. I was a Navy captain on the staff of General Westmoreland, and somebody came to me one day and said, "Why doesn't the Navy get some boats and carry soldiers around in South Vietnam?" And so in the river, in the Delta area. And I said, that's a good idea. So we talked about and designed a boat. I designed a doctrine to go with it and sent back that through my boss, through Sink Pack, who was the Commander-in-Chief Pacific, and then on back to the Navy Department. And it was finally accepted, and they bought the boats and built them. And so it was the first time that we'd had boats in river warfare and riverine warfare since the Civil War in the Mississippi. And I think Admiral Foote, F-O-T-T-E, was the guy who did it then, but I'm not sure of that.
Okay, I'm going to stop so we can turn our tape over.
Okay.
Because we're just about to the end.
Okay.
Yes.
But that's a Navy thing. It's not an Antarctic thing.
That's okay. But all are interesting, so that's as important to us as well. For your Antarctic thing, I think we've already covered what you felt were most important, or is there anything more you'd like to add about that?
The only other thing is that I think that the Science Foundation has made a mistake in hiring civilians to do the job that the Navy used to do, and in getting the Air National Guard from the state of New York, who have to do the airplane, the C-130 work. And the people who were in the Navy who made a career of that really loved doing it, were very proud of the job they were doing, and that's all the people. So there's a couple of notebooks in front of you there, those little ones, blue ones, to your right, to the left of your glass. Yes, and that the top one was given me by my predecessor, and it shows pictures of me when I my first trip to the ice, and going to various stations and so forth. And
these are great.
Yeah. And I did one of these. He did one of these for every visitor, VIP visitor that went down there, and so did I. I continued that with a handwritten note in front.
That's really
and
nice.
And pictures of their trip and pictures of them at various places in the ice. One of the things I did in Antarctica that had not been done before is I established a flag for each of the nations that was then a signature to the Antarctic Treaty around the South Pole. And I have pictures, I have a slide in my dog and pony show of these lady scientists getting off the airplane, you know, arm in arm with me, and also at the South Pole with these flags around them. So we can you can see that.
That's very interesting.
And I don't know what's there now, because now instead of 12 original nations signed this Antarctic Treaty, and later on there were four more that acceded to it while I was there, so we had 16 flags around the pole, and now there are some 38 or 40 nations that have acceded to the treaty.
When you discuss your accomplishments, that sort of leads us to maybe disappointments or things that you would like to have seen done differently. Do you have anything to say about that? You did mention briefly about your feeling that the National Science Foundation giving
you
jobs.
Well, I think they made a mistake by getting the Navy out of the South Pole, because our CBs built the current South Pole station. I ordered it during my trip down there. At my last trip down there, we ordered this geodesic dome, and the CBs put it together, and when they left, now there are civilians, and the South Pole currently is having real problems with, they wanted to give their contract to whom? To Raytheon, and I think the current outfit that does it is ASA, and I don't know what that stands for, and they're suing to keep the contract. And I think the Science Foundation is going to have labor problems. We didn't have labor problems.
That's a good point. What sorts, you've kind of mentioned some of the documentation that you still have about your time in Antarctica. Do you have other things beside these notebooks? And what other things do you have in your...
Yes, in documentation, I have, and I don't have it out here to look at, I have one of the operation orders that we did for 1 year that I was down there. And this was written by my staff back in Washington, told the people who are going to be there, talked about the communications, how we would take flights from Christchurch to the South Pole, to McMurdo and then to the South Pole, to Bird Station to put these people in. You know, the Navy pilot and the current pilots, the Air Force, are doing this too, the Air National Guard. The way they would decide whether or not to land someplace on the continent. They would fly on the continent and drop their skis and fly along dragging the skis in the snow. And then they'd fly up and look, turn around and look, and if the snow had caved in someplace, that's a crevasse. Mm-hmm. So they didn't land there. They'd go somewhere else and drag the skis again. And if they didn't have that, then they could land. And that's how they put these scientists in various places like that. And this last year, the Air National Guard, at least I saw a picture of this, didn't lose one of the planes. They had one of the planes get into a crevasse, and I had an awful time getting it clear.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of photos in the collections at Ohio State of
various
pieces of equipment and people
hanging
into those
crevasses. Yeah, I lost a Hercules, and we had C-121s, these Super Connies, and we lost one of those at the ice. Mm-hmm. The Super Connie couldn't fly all the way to McMurdo and fly back to New Zealand. So after it got past the point of no return, it had to go on. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, these blizzards can come up over in 15 minutes, and they can't see, and it's a crosswind. So this plane had to land, and fortunately we didn't lose anybody. We lost a C-130 because one of our most experienced pilots taxied over a sort of a scarp that he couldn't see. He taxied at a 45-degree angle over that. It dropped a wing, the wing tore off, and the airplane caught on fire and burned. Mm-hmm. Nobody was burned or was hurt there. So the Antarctic is an unforgiving place.
Okay, Callie, I think we're at the end, but I'd like to find out if there's anything you wish that I had asked while I was here, or anything else you'd like to add.
Well, in the documentation, you've seen my South Pole certificate, and you've seen a group of South Pole pictures, so not South Pole, but Antarctic pictures. Mm-hmm. So you can see I'm still quite interested in this wonderful tour in Antarctica, which wasn't a real career-enhancing tour, but it was a wonderful tour.
Very good. Thank you.
And I can't think of anything else that might be useful about the Naval Antarctic Support Force, except I'm very disappointed that it's finished. Mm-hmm. We had one question that you didn't ask.
Okay.
When I was there, we had a nuclear power station.
Okay.
And this was transportable by Hercules and was put in. And it was taken out the year after I left because the liquid container in which the core was, developed a tiny leak. So this thing was taken apart and flown back to the States. And the control panel and it's probably the same control panel, is now in the CB Museum, since the CBs ran this, at Port Hueneme in California. And I saw it there when the NSF, the Naval Antarctic Support Force, was disestablished. We saw it there.
Okay. Can you think of anything else that I should know or that you want to share?
I don't think, Mary talked about, I was the senior naval officer in New Zealand, the senior United States naval officer in New Zealand, and consequently had much to do with the New Zealand government. As I told you, that the prime minister was at my feet at one of these things, sitting on the floor in front of me. And one of the bad things that came down was we had a Minnesotan who wanted to fly to the South Pole, and he had a C-121, which when it took off couldn't fly all the way there and back. It had to land if it was there. And this man, I tried to keep him from there. He flew into New Zealand without permission of the New Zealand government. Because he was an American, the New Zealand government landed on me and wanted me to get him out of there, which he wanted to fly to the South Pole. The annual ice runway, when he was there, it was warm enough the SEALs were coming up through the runway and put holes, and they couldn't use it anymore. He had to have skis.
Okay.
And he finally left, and I'm real pleased with that, when he left. Made things a lot easier for me.
Well, this, I think, will conclude our interview. And again, this is March 7th, Tuesday, and we're in Tucson, Arizona, wrapping up our interview with Kelly Welch. Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.